Psalm 75. We give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks for your name is near. We recount your wondrous deeds. At the set time that I appoint, I will judge with equity. When the earth totters and all its inhabitants, it is I who keep steady its pillars. I say to the boastful, do not boast, and to the wicked, do not lift up your horn. Do not lift up your horn on high or speak with haughty neck. For not from the east or from the west, and not from the wilderness comes lifting up, but it is God who executes judgment, putting down one and lifting up another. For in the hand of the Lord there is a cup with foaming wine well mixed, and he pours out from it, and all the wicked of the earth shall drain it down to the dregs. But I will declare it forever, I will sing praises to the God of Jacob. All the horns of the wicked I will cut off, but the horns of the righteous shall be lifted up. In Judah God is known, his name is great in Israel. His abode has been established in Salem, his dwelling place in Zion. There he broke the flashing arrows, the shield, the sword, and the weapons of war. Glorious are you, more majestic than the mountains of prey. The stout-hearted were stripped of their spoil. They sank into sleep. All the men of war were unable to use their hands. At your rebuke, O God of Jacob, both rider and horse lay stunned. But you are to be feared. Who can stand before you when once your anger is roused? From the heavens you uttered judgment, the earth feared and was still, when God arose to establish judgment, to save all the humble of the earth. Surely the wrath of man shall praise you, the remnant of wrath you will put on like a belt. Make your vows to the Lord your God and perform them. Let all round him bring gifts to him who is to be feared, who cuts off the spirit of princes, who is to be feared by the kings of the earth.
Great, thank you very much, Karen. Well, good morning to you all. This appeared on the BBC News website, the BBC Wales page, actually, a few days ago, and somebody sent me a link to it. It's about a minister, a church minister in Wales, who's got himself into a bit of bother. Let me read from it. The church in Wales says it is investigating after a Gwynedd rector burnt some pages from the Bible. The Reverend Geraint ap Ewyth of St. Peter ad Vincula Church, Pennell. Am I pronouncing all these things right? Who knows? Also, he also cut up pages from the King James Bible to create an artwork. Unveiling it at a church event, he said it revealed a cruel and vile God. The Bishop of Bangor said, destroying parts of the Bible we don't like is disrespectful and will offend many people. Mr. ap Ewyth told BBC Wales he had burnt scraps of cut-up passages at the public event because he had been making a statement as part of an art experiment. But he said he'd had nothing but support from people at the nearby church. He was gobsmacked. He revealed his controversial piece of art at an event to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. That's this year, 400 years since the King James Bible was translated into English. He said, I find it highly offensive that people would think I have given my life to serving that type of God, and that I would regard the words of the King James Bible as sacred truth. I cut out all the nasty bits of that Bible, the language of which is being celebrated all over the place this year, because I don't think you can separate that language from the God it is representing. I was gobsmacked that no programs or articles are representing the cruelty, revenge, and hatred of this version of God. He said it's the most popular version of God as cruel that he takes exception to, whereas he thinks more attention should be paid to what he calls God's life work and the view that God is love. People have told me they turned away from the real message of Jesus because of this God, that this version puts lots of people off him as children. My version of God is Jesus, who was pure compassion and unconditional love. He said he also planned to create a wall of shame at the church, naming all of God's cruel actions. The rector claimed incredible support from parishioners. Now, you might feel that his methods are a bit over the top, but many people would agree with Reverend ap Ewyth's overall project. Doing away with the God of cruelty and revenge and replacing him with the God of pure compassion and unconditional love. So somebody else in the media recently, Marcus Brigstocke, the comedian, he's recently published a book And in it he talks about how, as an agnostic, he'd like to believe in God, just not the God of the Bible. For him, he sees the Father of Jesus, the God of the Bible, as a thug. And for many people, there's this feeling that there's a tension between the God we see in the not-so-nice bits of the Bible and the God we see in Jesus. But, of course, for the Christian, the solution isn't nearly so easy as Reverend Ap Euth's example might suggest. So here's the Bishop of Bangor, in fact, Andy John, talking about what this Reverend has done. I've written to the Reverend Geraint Ap Euth and will be investigating the matter further. There are parts of the Bible that we struggle to understand today because culturally our life is so far removed from that period in which the Bible was written. However, this is the interesting bit, it is not given to us to pick and choose. Sometimes the most challenging parts are those which we need to wrestle with most of all. The fact is that the God of the Bible judges. He has in the past. He does so even now. And the Bible says he will do in the future. We can't get away from it. It's all over the Bible. If we want to tear those parts out of our Bible, we really would end up with very little left that made any sense. It's all over the Bible, it's all over the Bible story, it's all over the Gospel. So maybe it's no surprise to learn that the perspective of the Bible and of the Bible writers is about 180 degrees from what our culture thinks. It's almost opposite. The Bible dares to say, and repeatedly does say, that judgment, God's judgment, is a good thing. It's a good thing. Psalm 75 and 76, they're two songs that celebrate the God of judgment. They are celebrations of the God of judgment. We're going to take each of them in turn this morning. We're going to see the ways in which they challenge us, in which they dare us, in which they provoke us to see God's judgment as an immensely positive thing. There's lots in each psalm, but we're just going to focus on one major thing that each of them has to say, okay? So, first of all, Psalm 75 says that God's judgment is a cause for thanksgiving. It's a cause for thanksgiving. That's how the psalm begins. We give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks, for your name is near. We recount your wondrous deeds. He says, let me talk about the wonderful things that God has done. Let me give thanks in public for them. And then the rest of the song is about judgment. That's the wondrous deeds that he's giving thanks for. God's wondrous deeds, his judgment. And he wants to show us, Asaph, who wrote this psalm, he wants to show us that God's judgment is a cause for thanksgiving because of what it shows us. And it shows us four things that are going to be sort of like little subheadings that will appear on the screen. And the first thing he says is God's judgment shows us that God is near his people. He's near his people. Just look again at verse 1. We give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks for your name is near. God himself had shown that he was near to them. He wasn't distant and removed, far away from them. He was near to them. Now remember the context. If you were here last week, we looked at Psalm 74, which was God's people crying out to God because of the mess that they were in. And they cried out, how long? How long are you going to let us just be trampled over by our enemies? How long are you going to leave us in this terrible state? How long are you going to carry on in your anger against us? They cried out, how long? And Psalm 75 gives an answer to that. God says, I will judge. I will answer your prayers. Just have a look at verse 2. At the set time that I appoint, I will judge with equity. See, in Psalm 73, and if you were with us in January when we looked at Psalm 74, you'll know that that was similar as well. It was saying, how come God just seems to let the wicked get away with it? And Psalm 75 comes along and answers those prayers and says, it's not going to go on forever. It's not going to go on forever. I do hear your prayers. I am near to you. I will answer at the set time that I appoint. You don't know when that is. But at the set time that I appoint, says God, I will judge. And I'll judge with equity. I'll put the wrongs right. I do hear your cries for justice. When God's people cry out to him, for their persecution to come to an end, or they cry out for God to come and sort his world out. He hears. He does hear. He's not deaf. He does answer. He will judge. He set the time. Sometimes the Bible story shows that that's him intervening in history and actually bringing judgments to bear in the here and now. But other times it's actually that he set a final day when he will right all the wrongs. And he'll judge everyone and everything with equity. But he will judge. That's the point of Psalm 75. He will judge. He is near. He listens to his people's cries for help. He will act. Judgment means that the prayers of God's people and their cries for justice do not fall on deaf ears. They don't fall on deaf ears. But it also shows that God is committed to his world. So it says in verse 2 that he's going to judge with equity, and then he describes a bit of what that means in verse 3. When the earth totters and all its inhabitants, it is I who keep steady its pillars. God is saying, look, sometimes it looks like the world is in a mess and like the whole thing is about to collapse. The world is tottering, or you could translate that word trembling. It's in a mess. It looks like it's all about to collapse, like the pillars are shaking and the whole thing is going to come crashing down. Because the world is full of wars and natural disasters and breakdown in relationships and cluelessness and ignorance and violence and wicked people running amok and seeming a lot of the time to get away with it. It looks like the whole world is tottering under this weight of chaos. And God says, what my judgment is it's me coming along and securing the pillars. The whole thing looks like it's going to crash in, and I come along and hold it steady, prevent it from descending into total chaos. In other words, it's saying when we read in the Bible about God judging in history, you know, say maybe what he does is he gets rid of a particularly nasty dictator, or he removes a political regime that has been standing in the way of his gospel going forward. That's the kind of thing God does. Or he brings a long and horrific war to an end. What he's doing is he's restraining the world from being as bad as it could be, from descending into total chaos. The whole thing's tottering, and God comes along with a steadying hand and holds it safe. Put another way, God's judgment is one of the main reasons that earth is not hell. Here we are making a complete wreck of his world. And really, if God were to allow human society and the world to go completely that way consistently, if he went to provide any restraining influence, earth would be hell. But no, he judges. He doesn't allow human evil to go as far as it possibly could if he didn't restrain it. He judges because he's committed to his world. And the final judgment day that the Bible talks about is the ultimate example of that. That's not just God preserving his creation from descending into chaos. It's actually purging his creation from all those forces of chaos altogether. It's God securing his world once and for all. Fixing those pillars so that they won't move, full stop. God's judgment, in other words, is the major reason that the new creation, what we sometimes think of as heaven, is not hell. Thirdly, God opposes human arrogance. That's the other thing Asaph wants us to see. That's the other reason why we're to give thanks for judgment, because it shows that God opposes human arrogance. Look at verse 4. It's still God speaking. I say to the boastful, do not boast, and to the wicked, do not lift up your horn. Do not lift up your horn on high or speak with haughty neck. It's a slightly strange way of putting things, isn't it? All you need to know really is that a horn was a symbol of power. Think of the animal world, think of an ox, where its horns are to do with its power and its strength. That kind of idea. The same with the idea of a haughty neck. You see, again, an animal like an ox, you'd put a yoke around it, around its neck, to steer it where to go. So a haughty neck is kind of like a neck that doesn't want to go where you're telling it to go, but wants to go its own way. It's just a way of describing arrogance and pride. those who want to lift themselves up and exalt themselves as powerful, those who don't want to do what God says. They want to promote themselves, they don't want to go God's way, but they want to go their own way, like some kind of stubborn animal. Those kind of people. And what Asaph is saying is saying, look, the fact that God is a God of judgment is a message to those kind of people. It's a message to them. That they shouldn't try to be boastful. They shouldn't be arrogant. They shouldn't lift up themselves and try and promote themselves. It's a message of judgment. Look at verse 6 and 7. For not from the east or from the west, or not from the wilderness comes lifting up, but it is God who executes judgment, putting down one and lifting up another. See the connection. He says in verse 4, don't lift up your horn, don't promote yourself. Who's the one that does the promoting and the demoting in the world? Well, it's God. Verse 7, it's God who executes judgment, putting down one and lifting up another. It's up to God. See, the one thing that people who are self-promoting and arrogant can't stand is the thought that they are not the ones in control of their destiny. That there's a God in heaven who decides who gets what promotion and who gets to do what, and that they don't. Ultimately, I think that's one of the reasons why the parts of the Bible that teach that God is judge are unpopular. That's one of the reasons. Shows us that God is God and we are not. We do not like the thought that our actions are accountable to God. We don't want that accountability. We want to go our own way. And not to have someone try and pull us back the other way. We don't like that thought. One of the ways we know that that's true is that it often isn't the idea of judging full stop that we don't like. It's just the idea that God will do the judging by his standards. That's the bit that we often don't like. People who don't like the idea of God as judge are often quite happy to make judgments themselves. Judgments like, it's unfair or unreasonable or morally repugnant for there to be a God who calls us to account. That's a judgment, isn't it? Or in the words of Reverend Geraint, the God of the Bible is vile and cruel. That's a judgment, isn't it? Those kind of judgments are fine, of course. It's God's kind of judgments that we can do without, thank you very much. God opposes such human arrogance. He says, it's not up to you, it's up to me. It's not up to you. And that's one of the reasons that judgment is such good news. It's a warning to the arrogant. We know, don't we, what happens in a world where the arrogant just get away with it. We know what happens. It's why lots of people have been finding a certain glee and satisfaction in what has happened with the news of the world. Isn't it? At last they've been found out. At last they've been shown up for what they're doing. It sends a warning to the arrogant, and it's a warning that God is a God who pours out wrath on the wicked and the arrogant. That's what he does. The wickedly arrogant, he pours out wrath on them. That's what's going on in verse 8. Just have a look at it with me. From the hand of the Lord there is a cup with foaming wine, well mixed, and he pours out from it, and all the wicked of the earth shall drain it down to the dregs. Basically, a cup full of nasty wine. It's a common metaphor in the Bible for God's wrath. It's like God is mixing, maybe like a master assassin. He's mixing some kind of potion up in this cup, and he gives it to the wicked, and they have to drink every last drop. Every fluid ounce of their just desserts they will get. Asaph wants us to see that judgment is for giving thanks because God lifts his people up. That's the fourth and final thing under this heading. It's not just about putting the arrogant down, it's about lifting his people up, the righteous. Look at verse 10. All the horns of the wicked I will cut off, but the horns of the righteous shall be lifted up. God's people get themselves lifted up. God takes power and influence and rule away from the wicked, and he gives it to his righteous people. Now, lots of people are uncomfortable with the idea of a God who will judge and of God having appointed a judgment day. But for Asaph and for the rest of the Bible, in actual fact, it's a good thing. It was good news that God wouldn't allow arrogance and evil to just go unchecked forever. It's good news. It was a good thing that God's people wouldn't be trampled on and subdued forever. It was good news. I think we can relate to that if we think about it. We do want to live in a world and in a universe where there's justice. We do want to see those who arrogantly snatch for power for themselves. We do want to see those kind of people eventually put down. We do want to see it. Again, you know, in the news of the world stuff and the fury that people have felt over the way journalists have been acting. Or look at the glee that some of us feel on election night. One of the things I really like about election night, why I stay up late every time there's a general election, is seeing some particularly infamously unpopular politicians get ousted. It's democracy at work. It's brilliant. That's why one of my massive disappointments at the last election was that Ed Balls just got in by a narrow majority. It's so frustrating. We've now got to wait 5 years anyway. But I remember when I was just too young to vote. I was just too young to vote by a few months in the 1997 election, when the Tories had been in power my whole life. I remember sitting up and watching up and really enjoying and seeing some of the heads roll, Michael Portillo and people like that. It was a lot of fun. It's because we feel this sense of justice. We want people who are arrogant and who snatch power for themselves and have a haughty neck and lift themselves up. We want to see them fall flat on their faces. We want to see them learn that they can't do that. They can't just get away with doing what they want forever. We want to see that happen. We want to see justice, don't we, for these killings that there have been in Norway. We like it when the scandals get uncovered and people are shown up for what they are. We don't like it when those who push and promote themselves get away with it. And actually, without judgment, human life and human history has less meaning and less dignity. It matters less. See, say somebody does something horrendous and gets away with it. Some kind of war criminal. And they just get away with it. Or some kind of child abuser or murderer where the case is never solved. They just get away with it. If there's a God, but he just doesn't judge, that's just not what he's like. He just sort of shrugs his shoulders. Yeah, sure, he sheds a tear along with us. But ultimately he can't and he won't do anything about it. Or if there's no God, then those crimes that I just described, they're just one set of atoms bumping into another set of atoms in a particular way. Who's to say that that shouldn't happen? Who's to say what should and shouldn't happen if there isn't a God? It's just atoms bumping around. Some set of atoms bump around in this way. Some set of atoms bump around in that way. Who's to say that that's wrong? And even if we could say it's right and wrong, who's going to do something about it? Either way, it's all just part of the big bummer of living in a universe where stuff happens. I'd say that that cheapens and devalues the suffering of those victims. That's what I'd say. I'd say that robs human life of a lot of its dignity and meaning. But if there's a God, if there's a God to whom every crime and sin matters, and a God who will somehow one day put all those wrongs right and call all those actions and the people who did them to account. It's very different, isn't it? The fact is, God cares too much about human beings and his world not to judge. He knows our actions matter. He can't pretend that they don't. He knows that we matter, and that the people you and I hurt and the people that hurt us, all of that matters. It matters. It means something. Judgment means that we don't live in a universe where stuff just happens. there's an order and there's meaning and there's things that we do of real consequences, and somehow, someday, the Bible teaches all of that will be figured out the way it should be. All of it. Secondly, let's have a look at Psalm 76. Psalm 75 says, God's judgment is a cause for giving thanks because of all of those things. God is near to his people. He cares about human arrogance. He cares about his world. He lifts up his people. Psalm 76 teaches us that God's judgment reveals God to us. So Psalm 75 talked about his name being near. Psalm 76 talks about his name being great. Just have a look at verse 1. In Judah, God is known. His name is great in Israel. Name is very, very significant in the Bible. It's identified with your character. There was some stats released this past week looking at what were the most popular new baby names in 2010. I think it's Olivia on the girl's side and Oliver on the boy's side. And Jack and Harry and I can't remember what the other girls' names were. We don't tend to pick names because we think they're linked to character. Sometimes we do. We pick names, and in some cultures around the world they do. They pick a name because it reflects your character. We tend to just do it because we like it, or because it's named after somebody famous, or that kind of thing. We think, you know, you can make a shortened version of it in the school play yard and it doesn't sound so horrendous anymore. That kind of thing. That was one of the reasons that my mum and dad picked all the names they did for us. I'm one of four, and they thought, people like to shorten names in England, and we need to pick names that when they're shortened, it's not so bad. And so they thought, well, Paul, that was my eldest brother, you can't shorten that. What about Michael? Yeah, we like the name Michael, because, you know, you can short that to Mick and Mickey, and they're not great, but that's all right. And Mike, yeah, we quite like that. So let's name our second son Michael John Jackson. What a great idea. Okay, never mind. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? But names reveal character in the Bible. When it says that God's name is great, it's a way of saying God is great. He's got the reputation of being great. It's not just sort of your name, it's what people think of when they hear your name. It's your character. God's name is great. And again, it's a song all about judgment. How is it that people who live in Judah know that God is great? How has he shown that to them? How has he revealed his greatness to them? Well, it's in judgment. It's in the way he's acted in judgment. Just have a look at verse 3. There he broke the flashing arrows, the shield, the sword, and the weapons of war. And verse 5, the stout-hearted were stripped of their spoil. They sank into sleep. All the men of war were unable to use their hands. It's written in the context of God rescuing the city of Jerusalem from her enemies by judging those enemies. Disarming them, defeating them, sending them away scared or dead. And again, we're shown, aren't we, this link between judgment and God's rescue of his people. They're always intimately linked in the Bible. God's judgment and his rescue of his people. They're always together. There's no rescue of God's people without their enemies being defeated. There's no securing of God's dwelling place. That's what verse 2 is on about. His abode has been established in Salem. His dwelling place in Zion. It's talking about Jerusalem. There's no securing of God's people as the place where he dwells without doing away with those who want to attack them. You can't do that. In other words, we track that all the way through to the end of the Bible story, where it talks about God's future in terms of not just an earthly Jerusalem, but a new heavenly Jerusalem, the new creation. If there's no judgment, then there's no new Jerusalem. Again, we go to the end of the Bible, we don't have time to look at it, but at the very end of the Bible, it talks as much about what and who is not in the New Jerusalem as who and what is in it. You can't make this place secure and safe and eternally happy and glorious if you have all the attackers in there. If you have the people who would wreck it and destroy it in there. There's no salvation without judgment. That's what the Bible teaches. Very, very clearly. Judgment and salvation. They're like two sides of the same coin, or two sides of the same train track. They go together. God is to be feared and worshipped by all peoples. That's the second thing that this psalm shows us. As it reveals God to us, it shows us that he's a God who's to be feared and to be worshipped by all peoples. So the first half of the psalm talks about how God shows himself to Israel, his people, as their champion and as the one who protects them, as the one who defeats their enemies. The second half shows what message that sends to the other nations of the world. Just have a look at verse 7. But you are to be feared. Who can stand before you when once your anger is roused? And then verse 10, 11 and 12, these are the key verses. Surely the wrath of man shall praise you, the remnant of wrath you will put on like a belt. Make your vows to the Lord your God and perform them. Let all around him bring gifts to him who is to be feared, who cuts off the spirit of princes, who is to be feared by the kings of the earth. What it's describing is it's saying those who haven't been destroyed by God's judgment on this day when he rescued Jerusalem, those who haven't been, what they're meant to do is to come and worship the God of Israel. They're meant to fear him and bow down to him and make vows to him and bring offerings to him. They're meant to become worshippers of God. Those who aren't swept aside by this wrath of his are meant to take heed and be warned that this God is not to be messed with. He's, verse 4, the glorious king of the world. Verse 4, glorious are you, more majestic than the mountains of prey. He's glorious and majestic. He's the king of the world. He's the protector of his people. He must be, he should be, worshipped. Again, we don't have time to explore this a lot, but it's something that keeps coming up in the Bible. That there's an evangelistic impact of the fact that God is a God of judgment. There's a missional, an evangelistic impact of God being a God of judgment. Suggests there's a danger in thinking what we often do, which is that in actual fact we can win more people to God's side, we think, by either ditching or turning down or explaining away the parts of the Bible that talk about judgment. I'm sure Reverend Garrett Ap Ewer thought he was doing God and Christianity a favour. I'm sure he thought that. But in judgment, God is revealed to be a majestic king, and is revealed to be the one to whom all the nations must bow. He's that one. In other words, there's no future in rebelling against him. That road leads nowhere. That's what judgment shows us. But there's a glorious future for those who do worship him. There's a glorious future, a wonderful future, a protected future, a sin-free and safe future for those who join his people. And this psalm makes it clear that that invitation ultimately goes out to all nations. It's not just a narrow thing. It's not just for Judah. It's to go out to all nations. Verse 10, the wrath of man shall praise you, the remnant of wrath you will put on like a belt. Make your vows to the Lord your God and perform them. Let all around him bring gifts to him who is to be feared. He cuts off the spirit of princes, who is to be feared by the kings of the earth. The kings of all the nations are invited to come and to fear the Lord and bow down before him. Now, somebody might still say or think, and look at all of this and say, that's great, but Psalm 75 and 76, they're in the Old Testament. Yeah, they're the Old Testament. Jesus was different, wasn't he? Isn't God himself different when we get to the New Testament? Put it crudely, sometimes we're tempted to think that God is sort of all tight and angsty and a bit miffed off in the Old Testament, and then somehow when Jesus comes along in the New Testament, he takes a chill pill. He realizes that the angry God routine doesn't really win many friends, and that you win friends and influence people by being nice. You know, sort of like New Labour under Tony Blair or David Cameron's Conservatives. The New Testament sees God becoming a sort of friendlier, a more electable version of himself. That kind of idea. But it's not just an Old Testament thing. If you've got time yourself this week, take a look Revelation chapter 14 and Revelation chapter 19. Or take a read through the Gospels and see who it is that you hear this message of judgment coming from and being about. Who is it that is this God who will judge all the earth, who will pour out his wrath on the wicked and the arrogant? Who is he? It's Jesus Christ. Who is the King of all the earth? Who, you know, no one can stand before him when his anger is roused. It's Jesus. It's Jesus. Who's going to be the one sat on the throne making the call on Judgment Day? It's Jesus. That's what the New Testament teaches. It's Jesus. Psalm 75 and 76, they're the same God that we see revealed in Jesus, in his life and in his death and in his resurrection. There's lots more we can say about this. Judgment Day is future in the Bible. The final Judgment Day when God rights all the wrongs, that's in the future. But the Bible talks about Jesus' death and resurrection as like a Judgment Day come early. Like that future Judgment Day has sort of stretched back into the past. And in a seed form, it arrives in Jesus' life and his death and his resurrection. So, at the cross, we see God putting down the arrogant and lifting up the righteous. The arrogant killed God's Son. They took him and they nailed him to a cross because they didn't want him to be God. They wanted to have that job themselves. But God defeated them when he raised Jesus up again 3 days later. He literally lifted up the righteous one, Jesus Christ, just like Psalm 75 says. And in that judgment on the cross, the Bible tells us God disarmed the rulers and authorities. Again, like Psalm 76, where in verse 3, God breaks the flashing arrows and the shield and the sword and the weapons of war. He disarms the enemies of God's people. Well, again, look it up yourself, but Colossians 2, verse 15 says that that's what God did on the cross. He disarmed the enemies of God's people. Satan and his kingdom were disarmed. Their arrows were broken, their shield and their spears were smashed on the cross. God won a victory there to secure the safety of his people, like Psalm 76. But there's more than that. There's even more than that. Just go back to Psalm 75, verse 8. Remember this metaphor that we looked at briefly for God's wrath. For in the hand of the Lord there is a cup with foaming wine, well mixed, and he pours out from it, and all the wicked of the earth shall drain it down to the dregs. Now look at these two verses on the screen from the Gospels. Words on the lips of Jesus. Mark 14, verse 36. And he said, that's Jesus, he's praying in the Garden of Gethsemane on the night that he was going to be taken to trial and then killed. And he says, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. That death that he's about to go to, he describes it as a cup that he's been given by God. John 18, verse 11. Again, a few moments after that, when the guards have come to take Jesus away, one of his disciples, Peter, draws out a sword, thinking he's defending Jesus, lops off somebody's ear. Jesus says to him, put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? We don't have a problem often with a judgment day for the greedy bankers, a judgment day for the corrupt politicians, a judgment day for the molesters, a judgment day for the neighbour three doors down with the ridiculously loud and jumpy dog. I don't have a problem with those things. But for ourselves? A judgment day for us? If Jesus was there dying on a cross for his people, and yet he describes that in terms of Psalm 75, a cup full to the brim, bubbling with God's wrath that he has to drink. That means that that's what you and I deserve, doesn't it? We can't read Psalm 75 and see this cup brimming full of God's wrath in God's hand and him saying, the wicked are going to drink every last drop and think, that's got nothing to do with me. That's for these wicked people over here. Snatching at power arrogantly. That's the default human condition. It's the most basic description of how the sin that lurks in all of our hearts manifests itself. Snatching at power that is not ours. It might just be control of my own life. It might just be expressed in frustration that other people get in the way of what I want to do. It might just be expressed in ignoring God and living as if he simply were not there. But it's arrogantly snatching at a power that is not ours. The cup of wrath is what we deserve. But in Jesus we see God himself stepping up and drinking down that wrath himself to the very last drop. If we read ourselves into these Psalms as standing on the right side of Judgment Day, which we should, it's only because the cup of wrath was drunk for us. In other words, you look at the cross and you see the God who judges. There's no tension between the God of one part of the Bible and the other parts of the Bible. There's no need to go through the Bible clipping things out and ripping things out in order to find a God of love buried beneath the bile and the cruelty of the God of judgment. It's not what we need to do. Now on the cross we see the loving God of judgment, drinking down that judgment himself, so that we who are arrogant and we who are proud can be made righteous. He will put the arrogant down, and he will lift up the righteous. But the consistent message of the Bible is that we can move from one group to the other. From a place where God's judgment works against us, where we're on the wrong side of these Psalms, to where God's judgment works for us and is good news, to where we're on the right side of these Psalms. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we hear your word here saying, in the hand of the Lord there is a cup with foaming wine, well mixed. And it says, you pour out from it, and all the wicked of the earth shall drain it down to the dregs. And then we hear Jesus say, shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? And we thank you that that is exactly what happened. Thank you that in your justice you don't overlook sin. Thank you that there is a judgment day coming when you will put all things to right. And thank you that a day came centuries before that future judgment day. That a judgment day came on the Lord Jesus so that it needn't come on us. For that we pray, Heavenly Father, make us truly thankful. Amen.